And here we go. It's another episode of We Talk Comics, number 160. 160 of these. I am the Crown Prince of Charisma, Mo. We have with us the Big Billy Busick of our podcast here, Brett.
Oh, that's great. It's changed up. How nice.
Yeah, the chief defender of the faith, Brett. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
It feels like forever since I talked to you.
I know. At least an hour.
Yeah, maybe an hour and a half. Maybe. Cub reporter Kay Keith.
Hi, happy to be here.
And the man with no nickname, Chris.
I was the guy who bought Daydreamers for cover price.
Excellent. And we wanted to, today's actually the exact day. It was 5 years ago to the day that we launched We Talk Comics. And we wanted to do something special for the 5th year anniversary. We didn't know if we were going to be able to hook up anything special. And then Keith came through. This is exactly 5 years ago, as I mentioned. 5 years ago, also, there was a piece that Comicosity does called 10 Tweets Thursday. And on 10 Tweets Thursday, they did a little profile on me where you ask little questions. You have to answer them within 140 characters like you would on Twitter. And one of the questions was, who are your favorite writers? And I said, that one wasn't hard. It was Peter David, Denny O'Neill, and the man who was joining us here today. My favorite comic book writer of all time. He is a well-known, of course, Kraven's Last Hunt, legendary story, Justice League International, self-titled books like, or self-published books, creator-owned books like Moonshadow, Brooklyn Dreams, so many more. He's here to tell us today about Augusta Wind, The Adventures of Augusta Wind, Volume 2, The Last Story, I believe is what it's called, the sequel to the 2012 Augusta Wind Adventures of Augusta Wind story from IDW. That was The Girl with the Umbrella. And also to tell us about the January 18th publication of Seekers into the Mystery, which originally came out from Vertigo, is now being published January 18th, 2017. You'll be able to get it from Dover Publications, is it?
That's right.
That's excellent. Sir, I am now going to mispronounce your name because I have to admit I am a little nervous, and I've talked to a lot of people. I never get nervous. So please tell us who you are.
I am J.M. DeMatteis.
That's what I was going to say, J.M. DeMatteis.
Yeah, sure, that's what you're going to say, sure.
Doing my absolute best here, sir. And so
J.M. DeFalco.
And we're joined by Keith Giffen is here.
So happy to have you on the show. And Keith, you hooked it up, so that makes up for the previous 159 episodes. So thank you very much for that, and for that reason you get the first question, sir.
I definitely like to work it out on average. JM, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
It has been we've wanted to have you for a while, and knowing that there's some of your work from the 90s work that we absolutely love is being collected, such as Seekers, and the last one, I believe, is also
right. Last one will be out next month, also from IDW. That's another Vertigo series of mine that they're recollecting in a nice hardcover edition.
They do amazing work for their collections.
Yeah. And then, you know, Seekers, I'm really excited about, because the entirety of Seekers has never been collected before. There was an edition, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago, that had the first 5 issues, and that was it. This is the whole shooting match, which is it was a 15-issue series. So it's going to be a very, very big book. And I'm it's one of the projects of mine that I'm the most proud of. So I'm really excited to see that coming out along with the last one.
Who I've got a sub question before my question. Who are your collaborators on Seekers into the Mystery?
I can tell that. I...
Now let me answer. Glenn Barr, John J. Muth, Michael Zulli, and Jill Thompson.
That's a fantastic lineup.
And I don't think I forgot anybody. I know we also had a few covers from John Bolton as well. So those will, and all the covers, everything will be in the book. And I wrote a new introduction, and we'll have some cool stuff in the back. They did a really great, Dover did a great edition last year of another Vertigo project of mine called Mercy. Beautiful edition of that. So it's just, you know, it's nice. There's so much stuff that had gone out of print, and I'm working on getting everything back in print. And so it's very exciting to have these projects because they're such deeply personal projects. You know, it means so much to me to get them back out there. And this way the people that read it the first time can have it again, and people that haven't discovered it hopefully will discover it this time around.
Well, that's what I want to start off with is you say these are deeply personal projects. Now, Seekers, last one, Moonshadow, there's kind of a thematic tie as well as a stylistic tie of all of these. They're kind of a mix. To me, they're kind of a mix of fairy tale and a spiritual tale. What has kept you coming back to that?
You know, I think all writers have their obsessions. You know, we all have the themes. I think you look at any writer, and you're going to find recurring themes. Those themes may deepen with time, they may expand with time, but those themes are there. And really, you know, interestingly, probably those themes are running through almost all my work, even the superhero work. If you have to dig a little bit more beneath the surface to find them there, they're a little more obvious in these books. And for me, it's, you know, it's always about, in one way, shape, or form, or another, it's about the search for meaning. Now, that meaning might be a psychological meaning, you know, the meanings in our own heads, or in the bigger picture, it's a spiritual meaning, like what is the meaning of all of this that we're sitting in the middle of right now. But it's really the search for meaning drives a lot of these stories. And whether it's psychological or spiritual or emotional, and just kind of trying to dig at the truth of our lives, whether it's the big cosmic truth or the small personal truth.
And do you feel that Seekers is part, is it its own take on that, or is it kind of feeding into that as a larger narrative for you?
You know, you like to think it's all a larger narrative, that it's all really, really part of a kind of the Uber story that one is writing. In fact, that's one of the themes that the second Augusta Wynn series gets into as it moves along. It's all story within story within story within story, whether I'm talking about my own personal work, I look at a lot, you know, whatever it is, 35 years worth of work that's out there, that if you kind of click all the pieces together, it becomes one big Uber story. But then I also feel that way about life itself, that, you know, I'm living my story, you're living your story, everybody, and yet we all sort of come together to form this massive story. And that's again, one of the themes of the work and a very specific theme of this new Augusta Wynn series. Because I really believe it's all story. We're all just sort of been dreamed into this incredible story, and then we're telling our sub stories within the bigger story, and on and on and on into infinity. We got heavy pretty quick, didn't we?
I wanted to ease into it, JM. I wanted to really start a softball question to start. I'm gonna ask one little bit in the hand of one of the other guys. So who are you? Are you in these stories? Are you a protagonist in the story? Or are you the narrator? Often these stories are being told with a storyteller.
Right. You know, that sort of started with Moonshadow. I like the idea of looking back on events after they've happened, of having a narrator who's got some distance on the main story. So that, especially in something like Moonshadow or Brooklyn Dream, which is overtly autobiographical, Moonshadow, which is really autobiography turned into fantasy, you know. But when you have a distance on the events, you can play with them more. Say in Brooklyn Dreams, where I can look at things that happened to me when I was so much younger, and look at them with a little bit of humor that I might not have had while they were happening, some insight that I might not have had when it was happening. But then, you know, again, so even it's profoundly personal, and not as the narrator, just me, but for any writer, every single character in the story is some aspect of your psyche, some aspect of you. So it's all personal. Even if I'm writing Spider-Man, it's personal. At the same time, the characters then take on lives of their own and that are very much independent of the writer. And one of the amazing things I had that happened to me when I was writing Moonshadow was I'm listening to, you know, you reach a certain point and the characters start talking to you. You're not telling the story, you're transcribing the story. You're taking notes on what the characters are telling you. And I was going all along Moonshadow, writing down everything old Moonshadow was telling me. And it was probably, you know, 9 or 10 issues into the series when I realized, I don't know if this guy's telling me the truth. And which was a huge revelation for me as the writer of the story, not realizing that he was spinning and basically telling me a metaphorical story. I was taking everything that the character was telling me as literally the truth of his life. When I realized around issue 9 or 10 that he was telling me a fairy tale version of his life. And then, of course, this brings us to the question of why do we write fantasy or fairy tale anyway? Because I think it's a way to get our hands on reality usually far better than when we write so-called realistic stories, because life to me feels like fantasy. It feels like a fairy tale. And I think that that's the best way to communicate this bizarre, wonderful universe that we're living in. On to the lighter questions. Or not.
Well, no, I actually had one, because just in consideration with what you've been talking about, one of the things that that Augusta Wind says is, it's the truth that counts, not the details. And that's kind of a theme that I've noticed in a lot as well, like where you do say, I'm not sure if this is lies or if it's the truth, but it doesn't matter because it's just an engaging story.
Right. Well, there's the details and there's the truth is maybe what I would say. You know, I think there's a line in Blood or one of those. I forget, they all blend together, where I'm going to tell you, maybe it's Brooklyn Dreams, is I'm going to tell you some lies about my life.
Yes.
And who knows, it just may turn out to be true. And, you know, one of the reasons why I like to say with Brooklyn Dreams, why I did not literally make it autobiography with the main character having my name, is that I did not want to be bound by the details of truth. So if I screwed it up and something had happened on a Tuesday, I said it happened on a Wednesday 3 months later, or this character didn't say exactly that, you know, so I had the freedom to not be precise about details, because my goal was not to get to the details, but to get to the truth. That said, most of Brooklyn Dreams is really pretty on the nose with the details, but I didn't want to be bound by them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And not making it literally me, I was able to make it in a way more me than if I tried to make it literally me.
Wow. How about a truly light question now?
Right.
And I can't believe I am asking this question, but I need to. Sorry? Right?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I can't believe this is the stupidest question I have ever asked, but I need to ask it.
No, I don't believe that.
Adventures of Augustus Wynn. Augusta Wynn, sorry. Very few people see the devious nature of balloons other than myself. Am I speaking to a fellow globophobic?
No, actually not. Are you really afraid of balloons?
Nervous around them. I don't go screaming from a room, but I keep an eye on a balloon if it's in the room.
That's just one of those visuals that came to me, these sort of like malevolent balloons, you know, didn't come from anything, any particular fear that I had, but they worked out great, didn't they? I mean, and you know, here's a guy I've been working with for years, and talk about not being able to pronounce names, Vasilis Gadzilis, okay, who's the artist. He's a wonderful artist from Greece. I got to go to a convention in Greece last fall, so we got to finally meet face to face. And, you know, the fun of Augusta Wynn has been that, you know, I'm cooking up all these weird characters and all these weird ideas, and then he likes to just design characters. He'll come up with insane designs, and he'll just send me randomly, like, you know, 10 characters, and I'll go through them and go, oh, look at that. I know where I can fit that in the story. So it's a great way to collaborate. You know, that's the way Kent Williams and I worked on Blood. He had a sketchbook filled with all these sketches, and I used those as the raw material to kind of stuff in the back of my head to create the story. Mike Plug and I worked the same way on Stardust Kid. He had all these designs and all these characters, and I had a story framework in place, and then I would look at these drawings and go, I know who that is. I know how they can fit in the story. It's a great way to work. The balloons, I forget that. I had a real specific name for them that I don't remember.
But balloonies. Balloonies.
Just balloonies? Okay. Oh, because they were loony. Right, balloonies.
I was also – they were all red, so I was kind of wondering if there was a race thing going on there, but –
No, they were just balloons. But, you know, but again, you know, I don't remember whether I came up with the balloons or Vasilis did. But I think the balloons came from me, though. And it was just something that I thought was a cool and sort of disturbing visual, because they were nasty little things. I hope I didn't have balloon nightmares or anything like that.
No, I'm okay.
That's good. I'm glad.
I have a quick question. We want a light question, right?
Okay.
Okay. How do you pronounce your name?
Brett actually has a good question for you.
Okay.
Well, actually, one of the things that I wanted to know about was to move into Seekers for a bit. Because now, originally that was, it is a 15-issue series, and right. You had intended it to be more, because it was.
Oh, yeah. I had just to start with, I had about 3 years worth of ideas that we're going to start with. I could have gone on that book for a good 5 years, probably. Yeah.
Now, so then I've got a couple of questions based on that. First is, did you have the same kind of artist, like four issue, and then one shot, four issue, one shot, scaled for all of it?
Yeah, that was the plan. That was the plan. You know, who knows? You know, 2 years, 3 years later, if it would have shifted. But that was the plan. I liked doing it that way. And we had Muth coming in to do all the one-off issues, which was amazing. And then all these other great artists. We had such an array of artists. So that was the framework that I thought I wanted to continue with as it went along. But, you know, things evolve. So it could have changed by year three, if we ever had a year three.
And I'm interested because, like, nowadays with Image, it seems like you can release a creator-owned book. And, I mean, it can sell, you know, 1,000 copies if you're willing to lose money to keep it running. So how is it that Vertigo worked then in those days that you know, your kind of creator-owned book could get canceled?
Because your creator-owned book was still being published by DC Comics, and they need to sell X number of copies of a comic book and keep it profitable. Because they, you know, the difference between doing that creator-owned book for Image and doing it for DC and for Vertigo in those days especially, I don't know exactly what the Vertigo deal is right now, but we were paid very well to do those books. You know, we were paid very, you know, we were paid the same as, I was probably getting the same rate as that I would get if I was writing Superman or Batman. So we got to do our creator stuff, our personal work, and be paid well for it, which is a very rare thing these days, unfortunately, in the comic book business. There are not a lot of places where you can go and be paid well and do original work. Usually the way it works these days is, you know, you do the mainstream characters, and that's where you make your money. Then you go off and you do your creator-owned project because you know you're going to get paid a third of that or possibly nothing while, you know, while you're working on the book. And you're doing it for the love, and you're hoping you're making money on the back end. But, in the, you know, for Vertigo and for Epic before it, we were paid well to do that work, which is a great and rare thing in this business. And I think it's still pretty much that way at Vertigo. I don't know if they pay as well as they did back in the day. But certainly, you know, you can make a good living doing those books. But that's a very rare case.
Now, just to go back to, and you think your name is hard to pronounce. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the artist's name. Vasilis is, maybe I can just go with the first name.
You can call him Vass. That's what I call him.
Vass, okay. Vass on the Adventures of Augusta Wind. And I'm going to mispronounce it as Chris now as Augustus in my head. But on that series, when he first did the first book in 2012, he was fairly inexperienced as a comic book artist, if I remember correctly. And now he's done the Bigger Bang, and he's done that work with you. Do you get more confident with what you're scripting that he's going to be able to fulfill your images the way you want them? And even in this volume, are you more confident to even open up things even more, knowing that he can portray it? Because he's really pretty freaking brilliant, to be honest.
He is, you know, and he was someone that I knew for some years before then. My son for a while was an editor at Devil's Due back when they still existed. And Vasilis had contacted him then and let him know that he was a fan of my work. So my son Cody put us together, and Vasilis just used to send me his work. And I was always incredibly impressed with his work. Really, I mean, he's so immensely talented. And what the weird thing was, and I'll get to the answer to your question, but this was really, really odd. I had had this Augusta Wind idea in my head for quite a while, and I kept getting this image of this girl in an almost Victorian dress with an umbrella in front of this old ruined castle. So one day I get in the mail a little sketchbook that Vasilis has done, and I'm flipping through it, and I get to a picture of a girl in a Victorian dress with an umbrella in front of a ruined castle. Now, I have never discussed this story with him, you know what I mean? So my brain just exploded, and I ran to the computer. I instantly emailed him and said, you have to draw this story. Mm-hmm. And then I pitched it to IDW with the both of us. So it was like he was born to do this story. Now, in answer to your question, yeah, you know, when you're first working with any artist, it takes a while to find the rhythm, to find each other. And, so, you know, sometimes you get together with really, really good artists, and you never get that chemistry. It never clicks. With Vasilis, it did, and it just got better as we went along. But in this series, it's even better. I think because we had the experience of working together before, and we trust each other, and we know each other in a way we didn't the first time around. And he's also, you know, we've had some discussions about the style, and he's he's adapted his inking style, and you'll see by the second or third issue, as the inking style evolves, that the art gets even better. And you know, I'm just so happy with what he's done with this series. I mean, I loved what he did with the first series. I'm even happier with what he's done with this series, because we've clicked even more, and our rhythm and our chemistry is better than ever.
What is the what's your writing, well, your creative style working with an artist? I mean, you would have come up through the old Marvel method of plot and handing that over.
You know, it's when I started at DC first, and everything was done full script at DC when I started.
Oh, okay.
So I learned my craft through writing full script, and I went over to Marvel where it was plot first. But you know, even when I do plot first, Vasilis and I right now are working on Augusta Wynn plot first. They're very, very detailed plots, page by page, panel by panel, you know, broken down. It still gives the artist a lot of leeway, but the advantage of working that way versus full script is then, you know, even if I have some, and I put lots of dialogue in the plot, so it's all really there. The themes are broken down, you know, the emotions are all broken down. It's all there in the plot. But then I get the art, and I get to react to the art. So there may be a sequence that I thought in my head was going to require a lot of words. And I get the art and I go, oh my God, everything I wanted to say is there in the pictures. It's only going to need three words. I may get another sequence that I thought would just be able to flow with the pictures. And I get the pictures and I realize that it needs explanation. Or I'm reacting to something in an expression in the artwork that I didn't see in my head when I was writing the art directions. So when you're doing the plot first, you're reacting more to what the artist has done. And there's more of a sort of a ping pong game going on there in a good way, a good creative ping pong game. When you're writing a full script, it's all in there. You know, page one, panel one, caption, dialogue, you know, how many panels are on the page, camera angles, everything. Now, five different artists are still going to interpret that five different ways, no matter how precise your script is. And in the best of all possible worlds, even when you're working full script, you have time to look that all over after it's been lettered to make adjustments, to make changes. So I really enjoy working both ways, but there is sort of a chemical magic to working plot first. But, you know, you hear these stories from back in the day when plot first meant the writer called the artist up, talked to him and told him like a 10-minute overview, and the artist goes off and draws 22 pages of story. That's not the way, you know, plot first works anymore, and certainly not. Or, you know, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, hey, Jack, let's bring back Dr. Doom. And, you know, give him three or four sentences, and then Kirby go out and create 10 universes based on that little thing, you know? You know, I've never worked quite that way.
You don't get on Skype and just act it out?
No. But, you know, but that was the genius of both those guys, because then Stan would get those pages back and write a completely different story on top of the story that Kirby drew. So the tension between the two of them created all this incredibly brilliant work, you know?
So how did it work then with Seekers? Because, I mean, obviously you worked with multiple brilliant artists. And
those were all full script.
Okay, and then...
Yeah.
And then now when you also created it, because even, like, with the lettering to me, like, Gaspar's work on the book is great. And so it all seems to kind of come together. Now, was lettering something that you kind of, you know, thought of in the grand scheme of things as well?
Lettering is one of my... pet peeves in this business, because the lettering as a writer, the lettering is so incredibly important. I've seen it over the years, a crappy lettering job. The reader doesn't realize it consciously, but suddenly the story doesn't read as well. And someone might read that story and go, oh, that was okay. And not realize that it's actually the lettering is affecting their perception of the story, because the lettering really is the delivery system, you know, for the story, for the words. And a great letterer will lift your story up, in a way that, again, consciously the reader is not going to realize it. So I have letterers that I really, really, really like, and I'm always delighted to find another great letterer. Whereas, you know, again, I've seen letterers really kind of drag the story down, too.
Brooklyn Dreams is shockingly good with the lettering. I mean, it is equally as much of the story as anything.
Right. That was Bob Lappin, wasn't it?
My book is
you're asking us.
Yes,
it was Bob Lappin who lettered all those Justice League stories that Keith and I did back in the original Justice League run, which God knows, with all that dialogue on the page, you really need a letterer who can fit it all on the page and also make it look good. The best letterers are artists in their own right. They really, really are. They are the single most underpraised, undervalued component of this comic book machine that we have, you know? And I do value them tremendously. Especially when I'm working with Keith, where these stories are so stuffed with dialogue, you really need a letterer who can really get it all on the page, fit it on the page, and make it look good.
It was Lapp, and I had that happen to be within arm's reach.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. Such a great job on that, and on all the stuff that the Justice League International stuff.
Just while we're all talking about lettering, Moonshadow had so much of it was written into the artwork. Now, was that lettered, or was that Muth's work?
No, that was Kevin Nolan, who was a phenomenal artist in his own right. Again, unbelievable lettering on that project. And I think we had one or two issues where he couldn't letter it, and we had Gaspar Saladino on the lettering. I think it was on Moonshadow. There were one or two Moonshadow issues that he lettered when Kevin couldn't do it. But, you know, Gaspar, who just passed away, sadly, also one of the great, great letterers in the history of comics. But Kevin Nolan, God, what a job he did on Moonshadow. Just brilliant, because he letters like an artist.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw was interesting back in the days when we shifted from hand lettering to computer lettering. The letterers that were not very good as hand letterers still weren't very good. And the guys that were great and wonderful artists in their own right brought that same sensibility to their computer lettering. You know, just because you had it on computer in a font didn't mean that you suddenly were great as a letterer. You have to have the sensibility for it and the artistic taste and style for it.
Does anyone else want to jump in? I have something else.
Chris, I think it's your turn.
Yeah, no, I was wondering, since you're going through and getting your old work republished, I'm wondering, are you noticing any changes in the remastering of your older work? Because certainly the Vertigo stuff was not published on modern cardstock. Or a paper stock. Are you noticing changes to your work? Are the colors more vibrant to you?
I that's a really good question, and one I really hadn't really thought about. But yeah, that's probably true. Just because the technology has moved up, and I just saw some Secrets pages that they sent me. Digitally the other day, and it looks great. It really looks great. Everything is crisper and sort of more dynamic now because the whole printing process is crisper and more dynamic. I mean, I've just been cleaning out some stuff in my house, and I've got these giant boxes of film. I mean, they used to make these big pieces of film for each page with layers on them, and you know, now it's all in a digital file. And I'm going, what am I going to do with these giant boxes with like 800 boxes of Seekers? You know what I mean? And all these things that when I got the rights back from DC, they'd send me these giant boxes of film if it hadn't been converted to digital, you know. So things have really changed tremendously. Now it's like all on a jump drive.
Two words, JM: Kickstarter rewards.
Yeah, because my wife was saying, don't throw it away. You know, you could do something with it. And I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to do with all this film? Yeah,
I'll take it.
We'll send your address.
I tell you, it'd be so expensive just to ship this stuff.
We'll come pick it up then.
I got a line of credit.
I know, you'll be over in 15 minutes, right?
Well, maybe we're in Canada, so 20.
Right, okay.
Now, JM, you've worked with a lot of amazing artists over the years.
Yes, I have.
My personal favorite comic artist you've done quite a lot of work with, and his work is in Seekers. What is Mike Zulli really like?
Michael Zulli is an amazing guy. Michael is, aside from being just a phenomenal artist in terms of what's on the page, he's a guy that really thinks about the story. Now, all artists think about the story. They have to in order to draw them. But Michael is one of those guys who's incredibly deep and incredibly philosophical. And when he looks at the story, and he'll call me up with questions that really challenge me and make me think about my own story, even in new and interesting ways. So he was a delight to work with I worked with him on a number of projects over the years, and one of my favorite collaborators, really. And one of the reasons was because he's a very deep guy, and we could, you know, get on the phone and, you know, one little aspect of the story and go off and have our own philosophical discussion that'll take us halfway around the universe and back again. Yeah. So it was great to work with him.
It's funny. I always pictured you having great philosophical questions or like talks with pretty much everybody. It's just based on your work that always just.
I don't know if it's with anybody. Certain guys, you know, especially artists, certain artists just want to, like, they just want to draw the story, and they may be thinking about it while they're drawing it, but they're not necessarily talking to me about it. And other guys like Zuli comes to mind. Norm Breyfogle was very much the same way when we were working on Spectre. We would have these really long, interesting discussions about all the philosophical ramifications of the story, you know? And that's always fun.
How has your like mindset changed? Has it changed at all since you did a lot of the more personal work at this point? Did, you know, as you kind of progressed in your life, how did your mind change?
Well, you know, we all hopefully change and evolve as human beings as the older we get, you know. It's an interesting thing. We do change, we evolve, and we deepen, I guess. But I think the framework of those themes that I talked about earlier, those themes continue. I think they're the same themes that probably obsessed me when I was 20, you know? They just deepen and expand as time goes by, and you see the nuance in it. And I think, I hope that the worldview expands with it. Because I think the same themes may have been there when I was younger, but maybe that they were narrower, and I was more, maybe my worldview is a little more concretized, as I think it tends to be when we're younger. You know, I think people think the reverse is true, that the older we get, the more concretized our worldview gets. But I think, you know, when we're younger, we think we know so much, so that we're very definitive, so that concrete kind of forms around. Even our broadest, most cosmic views can have a layer of concrete around it. And I found the older I get, the more that concrete breaks away and allows rooms for 1,000 other perspectives. So I hope that's the shift that's happened over the years. Did that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Totally, totally. Fantastic.
I was just about to look up concretified.
I don't think I've ever even used that word before, but it's, you know, I just suddenly saw this concrete tunnel form around my views and how, you know, and you know, when I was younger, I was so very definitive and sort of opinionated in a way that could form concrete around it. And I think the older you get, the more you realize that you know, all 1,000 different truths can fit into the same larger truth, you know? And it doesn't have to be one way or the other. Both ways can coexist. I was torn by duality when I was younger, you know, the opposites. And then suddenly, you know, you grow up and you realize all those opposites, they can happily coexist. Just because one thing is the opposite of the other doesn't mean they're not connected and they can't coexist happily.
I think the reason you might have never used it before is I think you also might have just invented it. So
that's a real word, concretized. We'll have to look that up. But I think that as soon as we're done,
Dan Brown can do it. He can do it.
that's what we'll call the episode, Mo. We didn't do a name at the top, so
we were thinking about the pilgrimage of J.M.
DeMatteis.
Damn it! I told you to keep to practice the right way.
Now, you've written some of the funniest comics I have ever read, as well as some of the most serious work. Does your approach change to writing this? You know, I'm going to write Larfleas. I need a beer and an orange soda or something. Or but before I start on this, or...
All I need is Keith Giffen and I'm fine. You know what I mean? you know, a lot of my work, you know, even this, like you look at Moonshadow, which people keep approaching like it's this deep and serious work. There's a lot of absurdity and humor in Moonshadow as well, you know? And in an ideal world, you want to be able to weave humor even into the most serious stories. Brooklyn Dreams has a lot of humor in it. Augusta Wind has humor in it. You know, occasionally you have a piece, like I think about Craven's Last Hunt, that it hits a certain tone. It's 6 issues, and there was not room for, like, Spider-Man making quips in that story. But in general, you want your stories to have both things. Now, when I'm working with Keith, the accent is a lot more on the humor, although underneath that humor, we also play with a lot of serious moments. But I always find working with Keith gives me permission to let my inner idiot out. you know, the idiot was always there with me anyway in my life. But working with Keith, it's like, okay, time to let the inner idiot have full reign. You know, I get to play with my comedy chops a lot more, because going in, we know for the most part, it's going to be pretty funny. Now, we may flip that around. I was just working on a Scooby-Doo issue of all things today. That's really, the whole thing is deadly serious from beginning to end. There's not a lot of humor in it. And the next issue might be completely all humor.
You just sold the book there. I have to buy
that. We're doing the secret history of Velma, and her backstory is pretty grim, actually.
Wow. That's awesome.
it actually reminds me. I think it was Spectacular Spider-Man 199. I think that it right before 200, because 200 was going to be so heavy. And there's a scene where it's Spider-Man and the Beast talking. And they're in a dire situation, and time is running out, and they're about to die, and everybody around them is going, solve the problem, you know how to solve the problem, you're scientists. And they're just talking and going. And it's just timing, and it was hilarious. And it's one of those things where, how difficult is it to just, is there a rhythm to comedy in comic books that took you a while to understand, or is it kind of instinctive?
You know, there is a rhythm to it. And it's interesting because I'll teach these writing workshops. It's called Imagination 101. And what I have to do in these workshops is explain things that I understand intuitively and that I've never had to explain before. And one of the things I talk about a lot is the link between music and writing. And I was a musician before I was a professional writer. So music is very important to me. And there's a rhythm to the panel. There's a rhythm to the page. There's a rhythm to the story, and comedy, certainly, you know, when I'm working with Keith, the burden for most of the dialogue is on me, and it's a certain kind of rat-a-tat dialogue, and it's a back-and-forth dialogue, and there is very, very much a rhythm to that. It's like those old 1930s movies where they're shooting dialogue back and forth so fast, and you could almost have a drum following the dialogue right behind it, so there's absolutely a rhythm. But in comics, there's a rhythm. You know, we write in these little captions, you know, and these little captions, it's almost like song lyrics. It's almost like poetry. And there is rhythm to, and I like using the captions to create a specific rhythm on the page that leads you to the end of the page, that then hooks you and gets you to turn to the next page. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a definite musicality and rhythm to writing a comedy in general, but to writing comics in general.
Now, I actually listened to your album just before we started recording here. I really like it.
Thank you.
And now, have you ever thought of releasing another album?
Yeah, that thing came out, I'm amazed to say, 20 years ago next year. And every year since then, I've said, I got to get back into the studio and do it. Because I have so many songs, you know what I mean? I've got really specific songs lined up for at least like two or three more albums, you know? And it's just a question of like, you know, I'm busy being a writer and then raising a family. And okay, when am I going to find the time and get the musicians and go back in and do it? And here I am 20 years later and I still haven't done it. And by God, I still want to do it. So yes. The next one's going to be a double album, because if it's going to take 20 years after that, I may be too old to sing, you know, who knows, you know?
Do you ever take...
Brett, I'm just going to say, it's a wonderful thing, though, because I mean, Brett listened to it on Google Music, Google Play. There was a subscription there, and I believe it's also on Spotify. And I mean, it's a new world to distribute the music as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's out there, and anyone can listen to it, hopefully. And I think all the tracks are even on YouTube. So, you know, you don't have to even pay for it, although I'd like you to pay for it. You can just go to YouTube and listen to the individual tracks. The album is called How Many Lifetimes.
Now, do you ever work, like with these songs that you have, do they ever kind of become a comic book story or the reverse?
Not a story, no. You know, but there have been certain lyrics of songs that I've woven into. I find myself writing, and if it's a poetic thing, and suddenly I realize, oh, wait, that was a lyric of one of my songs that I just used, you know? There was, way back in the day, there was in the Martian Manhunter series I did at DC back in the 90s, and there was a little bit of poetry that was coming out of the Martian Manhunter's mouth. It was I was just lifted a lyric from a song I'd written. You know? So they interpenetrate that way.
So the cover actually is in front of the Taj Mahal. Have you been to India many times?
I have been to India 8 times. And I'm supposed to. This is amazing. I'm going back. I went 8 times on my on my own for my own trips. Yeah. I'm going back for a comic book convention in November.
Wow, that's fantastic.
I was the joke for years at Friends. I can't wait to get invited to Mumbai Comic Con or whatever. And in the past few years, all these comic cons have been sprouting up all over India. So I got invited to the Bangalore Comic Con. We'll go. My wife and I are going to go there for that, and then go off on our own after we're done. So it'll be the first time in 11 years that I've been there. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been to India before, and it's an amazing country, and so I was, I always felt like you kind of fit with that thematic spirituality. So
yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very important part of my life. Those journeys there have been very, very significant for me.
And one of the things about if we can go back to the Adventures of Augusta Wind, because sure. I mean that's why you're here after all.
Yeah, that's right. Once and now.
If we go back to that a little bit, there's a lot of wonderful characters in those books. What can you tell people a little bit about each of the characters, maybe a brief bit, just so they understand kind of what the world is that they're getting into? And is there a character that you consistently hear from people that's their favorite?
I don't know about that. I have a favorite is a character called Mr. Snabbit, who's half half snake and half rabbit, and he's a very sort of funny, neurotic little creature, and he's Augusta's best friend. The premise is that Augusta, originally in the first series, thinks she's this normal, everyday little girl named Augusta Webster. What she doesn't know is that she's been sort of downloaded into this story to protect her because there's someone out there out to get her. This family never even knew she existed, and then suddenly she's inserted into the story of their lives, complete with memories of them being her daughter. But then she discovers that there's a creature called the Story Killer that's out to get her and comes and upends her life, and she realizes that she's not Augusta Webster. She's Augusta Wind, and she is a teller from Nowhere Island. And the tellers are the people that basically create all the stories that become all our lives and all the sub-stories in our lives. And the Story Killer is essentially trying to erase all the tellers, so once he erases them, all the stories disappear, and the entire universe itself disappears. In the first series, we kind of set that up, and she had an adventure. But the second series, it all comes to a head, and we confront the Story Killer. We learn the backstory of the Story Killer, and it all comes to a boil. It's a very, very big story. It's a quote all ages story. So I write it in a way that I think is kid friendly. But kid friendly in the sense of what I think my aim when I write these all ages stories like Abadazad or Stardust Kid or Augusta Wind, what I keep in mind is the best of children's literature, smart, literate, poetic stuff. Not lowest common denominator kiddie stuff, but really a high quality stuff, I hope. And at least that's my aim. Whether I succeed or not, I don't know. And Augusta, I think, fits that mold. But I want it to be a story that a parent and a child could read together, but that doesn't mean that it's not filled with wonderful ideas and great themes and philosophical concepts. I forget, it might have been Madeline L'Engle who said something to the, I'm going to mangle the quote, but the essence of the quote was that when she wants to write a story that's really very deep and very difficult, she writes a children's book. And those kind of stories really create a great framework to explore big, wonderful ideas, and that's what we're trying to do with Augusta Wind, while you're having a fun fairy tale with adventure and humor in it.
I also love Mr. Snabbit, and I particularly enjoy kind of the interaction he has with the Oliphant. Am I saying that correct?
Oh, the Omniphant. Yeah.
Omniphant. Yeah. Thank you. Right, Omniphant. Right. And they're kind of...
The fun of this kind of story is just making up these weird names for creatures and these weird worlds. And then you're sitting there and suddenly the word Omniphant pops up on the computer. Yeah, that's a great one. I don't know. Where did I get that from? I don't know, but that's his name, And off we go. It's one of the things I love about doing any creator-owned thing, but especially a series like Augusta Wind and Moonshadow is very similar, Abadazad Stardust Kid. in that you're creating not just a story, but an entire universe and populating it with an entire universe of characters. And it's like you just sort of rip open the door to your unconscious and just let it pour out. And more often than not, I'm surprised by what's in the story. And that's when I know I'm onto something good, when characters pop up, when events happen that I never knew or planned for or expected. And then I let the story lead me on. It's so much fun.
You know, I don't, what's that concrete word you just invented? Because you should weave that into Augusta Wind somehow. Right. And,
Concretized. I think I'm telling you it's a real word.
Well, you know, if you did just invent it, you did it on our podcast. So we actually technically own it. So, yeah, well, just so you know, in case.
The copyright is in my name. I'm sorry.
just a bit of back end when it gets turned into a TV property.
Concretize the motion picture.
So, with it being a 4-year wait, why is there a 4-year wait between the Augusta Augusta Wind
4 years?
Volume 1 and 2? And, pardon me?
I guess it has been. Yeah, you know, it's just one of the things where you know, we sort of wrap that up, and I got involved in other projects, and Vasilis got involved in other projects. And, you know, by the time we got around to going back to IDW and saying, hey, let's do another one, it was just time had passed. And then also, you know, when you're working on these creator-owned things, the reality is, as I said earlier, you're not making the money that you're making if you're writing Superman or Batman or Justice League Dark or whatever it may be for Marvel or DC. So you have to find the time to work on this other project. So it took us a while. Even once we've kind of got the contracts in motion and got the project set up, we had to take our time. Especially the first few issues, we really took our time, which actually is a good thing because it allowed us to put the quality into that we needed. And then, you know, once the book starts, you know, starts moving along and suddenly there's a schedule, then you have to pop them out a little more quickly. And but that's it, you know, there was no great deep reason other than it just took us time with our other projects to find the time to come back. But we knew all along that we wanted to come back and revisit these characters because I knew the story wasn't finished. You know, the first series completed a story, but it also ended on a little cliffhanger as well. This series finishes the story. The story actually comes to an end. In fact, the entire universe, without giving too much away, comes to an end. But of course, other things happen as well.
Well, it's called the last story, so we kind of, you know,
It's the last story within the story, but it's also the last story. But of course, when you're writing stories within stories within stories, who knows, there may be another story hidden within the folds of this story that may lead us to a third Augusta Wind series. You never know.
Dude, you just blew my mind. Is there any concern, though? Do you have any concern when you're talking about a 4-year wait and you have the people that enjoyed the series the first time, and maybe there was some of parents reading to children and now they're a little bit older, getting it back into the hands of the people who enjoyed it the first time?
I hadn't thought about that, and you just have to trust that the people that enjoyed it the first time will come back, and that this story is written in a way that if you were 8 years old when you read the first story and now you're 12 now, you'll still enjoy this story. If you were 12 and now you're 16, because I'm writing in such a way that I would want it to be approachable by all ages. And then, you know, the good thing about kids is there's a whole new batch that have come along. So people keep having them, so hopefully they will discover this. And of course, the first story is, you know, that's still out there in a collected edition in print. And then we'll get a collected edition here. And then hopefully down the line, there'll be an omnibus collecting the entire thing in one big volume. There are kids reading Harry Potter for the first time today. Right? You know, or reading Alice in Wonderland for the first time today. So hopefully these kinds of stories have a perpetual life.
Chris, please go ahead.
Just because Augusta Wind would lend itself to this. I was actually thinking about rereading it, trying to find little Easter eggs, allusions to your other work. Are there any? Can you save me some time here?
You know,
just lazy.
I'm sorry. Look for yourself. I'm not going to spoon feed you. You know, there. I honestly can't think of something that's coming to mind, but I do that with my work anyway. As we were talking about earlier, it's all sort of part of the Uber story. You know, I'll give something away. There's something in Augusta Wind that comes up in this series, and it's called the Tale, T-A-L-E, Whale, the Tale Whale. And it's this mammoth beast that essentially lives at the bottom of the waters of the cosmic unconscious that contains every story ever told, you know? And it came about from just from this very idea that we're talking about of all stories being contained in the Uber story. And so there are things in all these stories. I'm sure there are things in Augusta Wynn that refer to other stories, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what it is. So now you're going to have to go and read it, and then you'll have to tell me what I put in there.
Oh, darn. I have to read more comics.
Right. Good. I'm going to give you guys a five-minute warning because I have to get going in about 5 minutes or so. And
that's fine, sir. We appreciate every second you've given us.
Because I'm sitting here realizing that I actually never had dinner, and I'm getting hypoglycemic, and you do not want to talk to me when my hypoglycemia hits big time. So, but
please, I'm also hypoglycemic. That's why I can't pronounce the name. That's what did it.
We can do a couple more questions for sure.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, when we talk about you going back and collecting things, I'm sure Moon Shadow's got to be high on the list of something you probably want to get out in a new collector's edition.
You know, we got the rights to Moon Shadow and Blood back from Vertigo, and we are exploring that right now. There's no project I want more back in print than Moon Shadow and Blood as well, which was a project that means a lot to me. But, you know, I want Moon Shadow out there forever, you know?
Of course, yeah.
Can I jump in just for a second?
Yeah, for sure.
Just because you brought up Blood, I want to... Many years ago, the four of us were doing short films.
I'm glad you're going to bring this up.
And our very first short film was a horror, a space alien horror slasher with a lot of fun to it. And we racked our brains trying to come up with a name. And we cribbed in the end, Blood a Tale.
Okay, I won't sue you.
appreciate that. You can, if you're looking for revenue, on our silent 8mm film.
Right. Yes. It'll cost me more to hire the lawyer than the money I get.
I believe we've purchased enough of your work, hopefully, to
even it out.
Yeah, well, and you know what? It's pretty good. It may be better than yours. I'm not saying. I mean, it may be not.
Dude, it had me in an Elvis suit. It wasn't good.
That's so, one thing we didn't have in Blood was anybody in an Elvis suit. That's true.
Maybe in Fallen 2.
Always time to remaster. Yeah.
That is something actually I wanted to ask you about, because you're talking about putting these back into print. Is this some things that you wish to yourself, you go, I'm not quite satisfied with that, but I'm going to put it out there the way it is, or how do you look back upon your work? Are you able to let it go? Are you satisfied with the work?
You know, there are some things I look back at and I cringe. I have to, because I see, you know, I see the flaws. I see the skill set I hadn't yet developed, you know, especially some of my early work. If I look at early work at DC or Marvel, certain stories. And there are some stories that, like, I'll say, oh, God, Marvel reprinted that? Oh, my God, why did they reprint that? But, you know, then you get a royalty check and you go, oh, I'm glad they reprinted that. But the flip side of that is I have to respect my younger self and the writer that I was then, because I know that I was writing all those stories to the absolute best of my ability, putting my heart and soul into it. And then, you know, one of the reasons why I will never or very, very rarely knock any stories of mine in public is because the story that I might be cringing in embarrassment with might be somebody's favorite story. And I've seen it at conventions. People walk up to me and say, you know, it's the first comic I ever read. It means so much to me. And so, you know, I don't want to sit out there and say, oh, I remember that thing I wrote. What a piece of crap that was. And it may have been a piece of crap to me, but somebody else might have really loved it, you know? So I've learned to over the years to respect my younger self and the writer that he was. The flip side of that is going back and reading some early things like, you know, early things like Moonshadow, where I go, oh my God, I can't believe that I actually wrote that because it's so good. You know? And I'm surprised by my younger self in that way, that the quality of the work is so high. So sometimes I get embarrassed, and sometimes I read it as if somebody else wrote it, because I can't, you know, sometimes it's like the Shoemaker and the Elves. I'll look for a story and I'll find some old story of mine that I wrote that maybe I never even got into print. And I'll go, oh my God, this is a fantastic story. And I take it and I use it, but it's like I wrote it so long ago that I don't even have the memory of writing it. So it might as well have been left in my file cabinet or in my computer by elves. You know, it's like, oh, well, I don't know, an elf left this story, but I'll take the credit for it and I'm going to use it now.
That's how we feel about our Blood a Tale. That's the same thing.
But, you know, in a way, it's a constant collaboration with my past self, because I always say to writers, never let go of your ideas, because I have had stuff that it's taken me literally 15, 20, 25 years before that story has made it out into the world. And so you're constantly collaborating with your younger self. And again, sometimes I'll just find a story at random and read it and go, oh my God, I forgot I ever wrote this. This is great. I have to develop this now. So I'm collaborating with myself from 10 or 15 or 20 years ago on a story now. It's really kind of interesting and odd and fun.
So if the Seekers collection sells really well, which I absolutely hope it does, would there be any thoughts then of kind of going back to the older stories that you have and maybe starting it up again?
You know, people have asked me that, and there are times in the past where I've thought, yeah, I would do that. And I don't know if I could do that now, you know? I think so much time has passed that I might want to just let that be. Now, there are certain stories that I had planned on using that I still have them floating around in the back of my head that I would like to do. They might not go emerge into the world as Seekers stories, but they may emerge into the world as stories. In fact, you know, my biggest frustration with Seekers was that the very next arc that we were going to do was the arc I wanted to do the most. It was the one I was really looking forward to, you know? And so that story has stayed with me all these years, and it may find its way out into the world. Maybe not as a Lucas Hart adventure, but that the story in some form will get out into the world.
Did you have an artist for that one?
I don't remember. I got to tell you, it's been a while. I don't remember. frustration with Seekers was that, you know, we had enough warning that I could write a last issue that, you know, and try to wrap it up. But that was not the way the story was ever going to end, you know? So mm-hmm. It has a finale that's not the finale, you know? And that has always frustrated me a little bit. I tried to give the readers an ending, and I hope I gave them, and that's what it is. It's an ending, but it's not the ending. And that was my big frustration about that. But at least we got to have, you know, they gave us some extra pages, and we got to do a final issue that had at least the sense of an ending to it, even if it wasn't the ending that I wanted to do.
And I don't think, I don't believe Glenn Barr's really done any work except for a Hellboy Jr. and a few covers in comic books since Seeker. So, yeah, you know, so I mean, threw the guy a bone.
Yeah, Glenn does, you know, his own art and shows and galleries, and maybe he does illustration and stuff. He doesn't do a lot of comics, so I'm really, really glad, and I feel graced that I got to work with him. I mean, our collaboration on Brooklyn Dreams was one of those sort of uncanny, mystical, metaphysical things where exactly what I saw in my head before I ever knew there was a Glenn Barr is what was on the page, you know? I remember when the editor up at DC, originally it wasn't Paradox, they had a Piranha Press, that's what it was. And it was a guy named Mark Nevelo, was the original editor of Piranha Press when I sold that project. And he showed me Glenn Barr's art, and I said, "That's the guy I've been seeing in my head." And the one of the highest compliments I was ever paid, a writer friend said to me, "You know, when I read that book, it read as if it was done by the same person, meaning a writer artist, one guy. That Glenn and I fused so beautifully on that story that it seemed like the product of one mind." And that's a very high compliment. But you can't make that happen. It either happens or it doesn't, you know, and it has nothing to do with the quality of the writing and the quality of the art. I've had stories where I think I've done a great job on the script and the artist has done a fantastic job on the art, and you put it together and it just lays there because the chemistry is not there. And with Glenn, the chemistry was just incredible. It was incredible. And all you can do at those points is just thank the gods that they allowed it to happen, you know, and it was such a personal story of mine. And yet Glenn translated in such a way that it became just as personal for him.
I'll thank the gods too, because that is one of my top five favorite comic stories of all time right there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. If I was going to pick the single best thing I've ever done on any given day, it very well might be Brooklyn Dreams. There are two or three other things that are like Moonshadow and Nevadazad that are up close, but I think if I was forced to pick one, it might be Brooklyn Dreams, but don't force me to pick one so I don't have to.
We won't. In fact, I do want to mention again, I know it is time for you to go and have some supper, but if there's just one more question I could ask you.
Sure, absolutely.
Also, just once again, I want to mention that, you know, I mean, over the years, you've made me laugh till I cried. You made me cry until all I could do left was laugh. Your work has been so personal to me. You are my favorite comic book writer of all time.
Thank you. Let me say this too. I don't take that lightly. I profoundly appreciate that. You know, I write the main reason I wrote. First, I write for myself, and then the second person I'm writing for is someone out there that I feel is going to take these stories into their hearts the same way that I'm pulling them from my heart. You know what I mean? So when I meet people, we spend most of our time as writers alone in a room with our imaginary friends. So that when I'm at a convention or I get an email or a letter from somebody or I talk to somebody like you, that really got the work, that it really means something to them. It means the world to me. So I do not take what you're saying lightly. It really means something to me, and I thank you for that.
And as I say, it means something to me too. It made me examine myself and the world around me. It's a mission accomplished, sir. I'd like to ask you, you have so many hidden gems that we could talk about, and obviously talk to you for about a year, and I don't think we get to everything.
Maybe we can do this again, down the line.
I wanted to ask you about this one because, just in case we don't, because I did always, here's a story that I don't think is ever given enough credit, because it's absolutely one of my favorite stories, and it's going in a bit different directions. We've been talking a lot about your creator own work, but this is Legends of the Dark Knight, issues 65 through 68, the third time that Batman met the Joker, a story called Going Sane. The artist on it, that guy's a name I can't pronounce. I don't know if it's Jostatin or Jostatin. Yeah. I have no idea. It's just too possible.
And he's a nice guy.
If you could, please, tell me your memories of that story.
I have to say, if I was going to go through my mainstream superhero stories, things done either for Marvel or DC, I would pick that as my absolute favorite. So you picked a good one there. It grew out of it's a really long story it ties into Craven's Last Hunt. I was pitching a Batman story as a graphic novel to DC in the 80s, and it had that element in it of the Joker killing Batman, but in that version he buried him alive the way Spider-Man was buried alive in Craven's Last Hunt, because this was pre-Craven's Last Hunt. That story got turned down at the time. I took those ideas, I played with them, it ended up finding a home in Craven's Last Hunt, but I had this idea about the Joker killing Batman, and the idea being that, if we snap, we go crazy. The Joker's already crazy. He snaps, he goes sane. And that was one of those stories that when I finally got to do it for Legends of the Dark Knight, certain stories, it's almost like you don't have to think about them. They just come roaring out. And I remember working on that and writing those plots, and it just, I didn't have to think about it. The story just hit the page, and it came pouring out of me. And it really is one of my absolute favorite stories. And the goal, I guess, looking back, was to write a Joker story that could make you cry for the Joker in the end, because it's really, it's Batman's story for sure, but it's really the Joker's story even more. And I'm very, very proud of that story. Joe Staton did an incredible job on it. And I'm glad you brought it up. It really, and I, DC, if you're out there listening, that needs to be back in print too. They put out a collected edition a few years ago, and then it went out of print, and they haven't brought it back. It's a story that over the years, a lot of people have come up to me and, I think it's one of the best Joker stories ever done. It's one of the best stories you've ever written. And so I would love to see it out there back in print.
Wonderful, sir. And now it is time for you to go and have something to eat. But first off, we have a little segment here we do on our podcast, since it's your chance here. We call it Plug Your Shit.
All right. Plug Your Shit, eh? Well, I'm kind of going to go with that, but I'm not going to go there. All right, so the Adventures of Augusta Wynn, the last story, is out right now. Scooby Apocalypse. Which Keith Giffen and I, if you've enjoyed my work with Keith Giffen over the years, you will enjoy Scooby Apocalypse. I've got a bunch of different creator-owned things that are in development right now that I can't really talk about right now. I'm doing a new project for a company called Black Mask, which is a great little indie imprint. I'm talking to IDW about another original right now. So I've got a lot of creator-owned things brewing. But they're just not in a place where I can talk about right now. I'm working on a really big TV project right now, which I've been developing with a producer for quite some time, and is literally out to the networks as we speak, and I can't talk about it. I have all this great shit that I can't really plug.
There is something listed on your IMDb. I don't know if that's the thing or not.
that's what it is, unless they changed it since the last time I looked, you know? But it's a TV series. It's an original TV series that I've created that we're out at the networks with as we speak. And, you know, in the world of television, who knows? That might mean that, like, next time we talk, I'll tell you that I have a TV series on the air. But the next time we talk, I'll tell you everybody passed on it. You never know. But I'm very—it's a project I'm really, really excited about, and we've been working on it for quite some time. I'm working with a producer named Dean Devlin, who's the guy that wrote and produced Independence Day and Stargate and the TV series Leverage and The Librarian. So we've been developing this for a while, and it's out there now, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you once more, sir. We really do appreciate it. If everybody else just wants to hang on a moment here, we'll wrap up off air without you. But thank you again. It's been everything we imagined.
Well, thank you. And I asked after thinking they were really great questions too. I really appreciated that.
Well, next time hopefully we'll get a chance to talk Life and Times of Savior 28 and some of the superhero work. That's what I'd like to do.
Yeah, and I would be happy to come back another time. So feel free to invite me.
Excellent.
How about next week?
we're ready anytime. Okay.
Well, just shoot me an email when you're ready, and we'll set up another time to talk.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Jam.
Thanks.
Great to talk to you guys. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
That was awesome.
This is the part of the podcast where you just fanboy out. that was huge for me. That was awesome. So everybody else, what did you guys learn anything that really stuck with you from what he said?
The man is smart.
S-M-R-T.
Yes, he concretized the thought that yes. He's smart for
some
me.
Of my thoughts got concretized.
He was answering questions before I thought of them.
The ones that had been concretized have been unconcretized. Yes. So I feel really honestly, it was like being in the best university lectures for me. Just that feeling of my brain is taking in a lot of learning that's going to roll through my head for months. Was the feeling. This was great. This was just a fantastic interview, and what a way to celebrate our fifth anniversary.
That's for sure. I mean, if we're going to celebrate our 10th anniversary, well then, you know, we got to truly double up to top this for that moment.
And Mo, that going sane question was awesome.
Oh, good. Thank you. I've always wanted to ask that. And I also have a few other hidden gems, I think, that he's done over the years that hopefully is.
I didn't want to go into the superhero stuff, and it wouldn't have been appropriate. But
Go Insane, I thought, just fit. And you know what? I think you're right, Keith, when you talk about just the university lectures, when you learn so much. I mean, other than, I think the only other time that I felt that to this degree was probably the discussion we had with Greg Rucka, where we were under the learning tree, and I walked out of that going, well, I'm smarter than I was when I went in. And I feel that way about this one as well.
Fantastic.
Sometimes they just break it down in such a way that it not only does it make sense, but it really concretizes the way you look at the way you look at comics. I'm never gonna stop now.
Or unconcretizes as needs be. Yes. I mean, if you're too concrete.
Yeah. I'm gonna be at work tomorrow and I'm gonna like spit out.
I noticed that none of us had guts. None of us had the guts to actually look it up to see if it exists, because if it didn't, none of us wanted to be the one.
I'm still not looking it up. I guess we should, should we close out the episode now?
Let's close out the episode. And the way we do that, we're going to go, oh, you two, you get to they'll announce next week's episode, yes. 161. Keith, of course, you got to top this now. Good luck.
Yeah, so no pressure.
Don't even try.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to try then.
Worst episode ever next week.
All right. We just wrap up the podcast now. No more episodes until the next time JM can come back.
Until 5 more years.
Last come back. 10th anniversary. We get Giffen with him. So an idea I've had for quite a long time, and we'll have to do a little Googling. Each of us will have to do a little Googling. It was Chris's birthday last week we met. And it got me thinking about an idea I've had for quite a long time, where each of us would review one comic We could bring anything we want, with the caveat that the comic has to have a cover date of the month we were born. So head off to the Google, head off to
your I don't even know what you
go to your Marvel Unlimited, find a comic book that was published the month you were born.
Month or that's date. Do we want to try one? If we want to go really crazy, we find the date.
I'm going to be honest.
Now, I'm not saying the date, like the date and year. I just mean the day of the month. Oh. Like, I'm October 28th.
Give it.
I bet you at some point in time there's an October 28th where books were
shipped. Well, since it's your topic next week, I think.
I'm just saying that would be awesome. Now, if you want to just make it October, that'll be easy.
I'm going to. I mean.
You mean 1973? I mean
May 1973 is what I tracked down.
For 1973.
The month and year. You've got your Marvel Unlimited.
Yes, I do.
You've got there's a lot. There's access to a lot of stuff out there. There's not a lot more than Marvel and DC. That's fair. The early 70s is still thin.
Yeah. You're right. I'm sure it's possible. I'm sure somebody somewhere's archive would shipped in October or May of the 70s somewhere.
If you go to our friends at Comicvine, they you can search by month, everything that was published that month, and then cross-reference.
Find it. So how are we going to find it? What do you expect me to buy it and buy and get it shipped to me on?
You've got Marvel Unlimited. There's a.
So in other words, all of you are going to have to borrow my Marvel Unlimited book to get this thing done. Be
ridiculous. There's lots there. These options will become available. You'll see. A whole world will open up for you.
Mine is so totally going to be Amazing Spider-Man.
Whatever Amazing Spider-Man came out, that's just easy.
It's 118 for me.
You already looked it up.
It's really good. Oh, wait. Perhaps Luke Cage Hero for Hire number 7. Iron Man 56.
Now we're talking. All of those will be
out. Keep going. I don't want to read any of those yet. Keep going.
You weren't born the same month.
Oh, shit. Yes. I forgot. Same year.
All right. Still around. And and then we'll do something to fill the other 45 minutes of the show the way this
is. Yeah. What I want to know is, here's going to be the most wonderful part about this, is what I like to do is I like it when we can announce our topic and the people can play along.
That's right.
So good luck, everyone.
Yes, maybe the Flash 220. It looks great. It's a good cover.
I had someone ask tell me that when they were listening to one of our Batman versus Superman, they kept yelling things at their speakers, and I said, "Well, keep doing that. That's the way we like to get listener feedback."
That's the only way we get.
Excellent.
All right.
But Chris, you're the oldest of us all. Do you think comics were even being published when you were born? Or
I'm pretty sure they were.
Okay.
I might have to go to Gold Key, but
No. There's Harvey Comics. Like, there's bound to be a playful little Audrey or something that won't be available for you.
The only way we'll know Chris's real age is by cutting him open and counting the rings.
It crosses my mind that I just bought that that giant Humble Bundle of Star Treks and something in there.
All right. Well, I think that is it. Officially, we're OUT. Don't find us. You already listened to us. You can tell people if you enjoyed this, but please support JM DeMatteis.
No. You're totally giving the exact one that he hates.
I know. DeMatteis.
DeMatteis.
JM DeMatteis.
Oh, Keith, I think I found a good one for you. All right. Creatures on the Loose featuring Thongor, Warrior of Lost Lemuria.
I've ordered the omnibus, but it hasn't come yet, so I don't know if I'll be able to do that one. All right, let's do this again in a week.
DeMatteis.
DeMatteis.